Hi everyone, and welcome back to the 14th video of the Old Testament Survey course. In this section, we'll look at the book of Leviticus, using the standard categories of background, organization, content, and theological themes. First, the background. As you recall, Leviticus is the third book of the Pentateuch, the five books of Moses. It is the continuing story of the founding of God's people Israel from the descendants of Abraham, into a covenant relationship with God after he had rescued them from Egypt and revealed himself and his righteous standards. And that's where we pick up Leviticus. It starts right where Exodus ends. But first, the name Leviticus. Leviticus is a Greek word that means pertaining to the Levites, that is, the descendants of Levi, one of Jacob's 12 sons. And all the priests and tabernacle workers are descended from Levi. Moses and Aaron are Levites. And Aaron was the first high priest, and all the priests are descended from him. Now, the Hebrew title for this book is from the first words of the book, "And he called." So notice that the book starts with the word "and." Now, this is an unusual word at the very beginning of any book. But it means, grammatically, Leviticus continues from Exodus without missing a beat, because it's the third part of a unified whole. So we cannot understand Leviticus except as part three of the five-volume Torah. Now, the authorship and the time of Leviticus, they're the same as the rest of Pentateuch. It was written by Moses just after the time of these events of the Exodus. But Leviticus is a freeze frame in the historical narrative. In other words, Leviticus is not narrative. It's not story. It does not tell events that happened. See, the story from the book of Exodus just kind of stops. And it's going to start again in the next book of Numbers. But Leviticus is primarily laws and instructions about religious life in the ancient Israelite community. And all these instructions are given and applied while the people are still camped at the base of Mount Sinai, where they remain throughout Leviticus. In other words, Leviticus is an extension of the laws and regulations that God gave Moses and the people of Israel at Mount Sinai. And Leviticus continues to address the question, how can a holy God live with an unholy people? See, the last part of Exodus told where worship would happen by describing the tabernacle. And now the book of Leviticus tells how worship will happen. It gives the divinely inspired and approved manner in which God should be worshiped by Israel. Now, Leviticus is a notoriously difficult book. It's the graveyard of all those well-intentioned Bible reading plans where people read through Genesis with no problem, through Exodus just fine, but when it gets to Leviticus, they kind of lose interest because they don't understand the significance of this book and it seems dry. But I hope that this course will help you to see the point of Leviticus and then be better able to understand it and apply it to your life, and love it as the Word of God. Now, let's look at the organization of Leviticus. This book is organized around two major goals, that is, two things that will happen if these instructions are followed well. The first goal is right worship, that is, proper worship that honors and pleases God. This section concentrates primarily on what takes place inside the tabernacle. And so it primarily addresses the activities of God's people, particularly the Levites, directed towards God in worship. But then the second goal is right living. That is, holy living that honors and pleases God. And the focus of this section is primarily what takes place outside the tabernacle, in everyday life. And this addresses the activities of all of God's people, towards one another, towards creation, and even towards themselves, but all in light of God's character and his revelation. And the second section is sometimes called the holiness code, because as we'll see, the emphasis of the section is on holiness. Now, the first section can be broken down into four divisions. The first describes acceptable sacrifices. The second describes an acceptable priesthood. The third describes acceptable worshipers. And then the last division describes the Day of Atonement. And we'll summarize the contents of each of these sections in a moment. But first, let's get a sense of the content by looking at a few key verses. The first key verse is chapter 11, verses 44 and 45, which says, "I am Yahweh, your God. Consecrate yourselves and be holy, because I am holy. Do not make yourselves unclean by any creature that moves about on the ground. I am Yahweh, who brought you up out of Egypt to be your God. Therefore, be holy, because I am holy." Now, this passage demonstrates the key idea of holiness and how important God takes holiness in the book of Leviticus. Now, we talked about this idea of holiness in an earlier section. It is being separate from the common and the unclean, being separate towards God, and being pure and morally upright. And in this passage, the connection is emphasized between God's holiness and the holiness that he demands from his people. We're to be holy because he is holy. Then next is chapter 16, verses 9 and 10. Where God's people are commanded, "Aaron shall bring the goat whose lot falls to the Lord and sacrifice it for a sin offering. But the goat chosen by lot as the scapegoat shall be presented alive before the Lord to be used for making atonement by sending it into the desert as a scapegoat." Now, this is part of the ceremony for the Day of Atonement. And there's two goats. One goat is sacrificed to make atonement by blood sacrifice, but the other is sent away, symbolizing the sins of the people leaving the camp, being removed far away, signifying the reality of forgiveness and the effectiveness of the atonement. It demonstrates the sins are gone. Next is chapter 16, verses 15 and 16, which says, "He shall then slaughter the goat for the sin offering for the people and take its blood behind the curtain and do with it as he did with the bull's blood. He shall sprinkle it on the atonement cover and in front of it. In this way, he will make atonement for the most holy place because of the uncleanness and rebellion of the Israelites. Whatever their sins have been, he is to do the same for the tent of meeting, which is among them in the midst of their uncleanness." Now, this passage is a continuation of the commandments for the Day of Atonement. And it describes the high priest entering the most holy place. Now, if you remember from the layout of the tabernacle, the center part of the tabernacle where was most holy, was only the Ark of the Covenant of God's presence. And the priest only entered this place one time a year, and that's described here. That is in the Day of Atonement. And it says that when he entered into this place through the curtain, he took blood from a sacrifice, and he makes atonement for the most holy place. Did you catch that? It says even the place of God's presence needs to be atoned for with blood sacrifices. Not that God's presence makes it unclean or sinful, not at all. But it says, because of the proximity of the uncleanness and rebellion of the people of God to God's holiness, this uncleanness of the people makes the need for atonement. Remember the question from Exodus, how can a holy God dwell among an unholy people? And the answer given clearly in Leviticus is through blood sacrifice. And this is brought up in the next key verse, chapter 17, verses 11 and 12. And it says, for the life of a creature is in the blood, and I have given it to you to make atonement for yourselves on the altar. It is the blood that makes atonement for one's life. Therefore I say to the Israelites, none of you may eat blood, nor may an alien living among you eat blood. Now, this passage tells us the nature of the atonement and the necessity of shedding blood, that is, life for life, because the penalty of sin is death. And therefore, blood and life should be taken seriously by God's people, because blood needs to be spilled, life needs to be given for atonement. And we don't see it now because it doesn't happen in our culture. Because of Jesus. Thank you, Jesus, very much. But the worship of the tabernacle was gory. It was full of blood. It was like a butcher shop. Because God demanded death for sin. And the way of atonement, the way to cover sin, was through the death of a substitute, as we'll come back and see later. Finally is chapter 19, verse 2. It says, speak to the entire assembly of Israel and say to them, be holy, because I, Yahweh your God, am holy. Now, this passage obviously repeats the idea from the earlier passage, and it emphasizes holiness, which again is central to the book of Leviticus. Now, these are the key verses from Leviticus. Now, let's look at the content of each section. And we're not going to be able to go into the level of detail which we did for Genesis and Exodus. But I hope you get a summary of the contents and understand these books as a whole, which will prepare you for further study. Now, this first section, as we mentioned, teaches how to worship rightly. It teaches about five types of sacrifices that are acceptable to God. These are the five types commanded in Leviticus, and the purpose for them is also given. First is the burnt offering. An entire animal is for slaughtered, and the entire carcass is burned up. That is giving it completely to God. Nothing is left. And this sacrifice acknowledges God's complete ownership and his due as Lord over all his people. Second is the cereal offering, also called the grain offering. This is basically the same idea as the burnt offering, except it consists of grain instead of an animal. And it's entirely consumed by the fire, wholly given to God. And then the third type of offering is the peace offering, sometimes called the fellowship offering. And this is a voluntary offering that anyone in Israel can choose. I'm just decide to give this. And it says, in essence, I'm giving this because I appreciate the Lord. I honor the Lord as my King and my God by voluntarily giving him something precious to me. And when someone brought a peace offering, a fellowship offering, part of it is burned, given to God. Part of it is given to the priest to eat. And part is eaten in the tabernacle, in the presence of God, by the one who offered it and by his family. It's kind of like eating a family meal in the presence of God as a way to strengthen the fellowship and relationship with God by showing him honor. And in each of these first three offerings, there's a summary statement that's repeated, and it is, they are an offering by fire a pleasing aroma to the Lord. And this shows that each of these offerings is seen as strengthening the connection between people and God by giving him the honor that is due to him. And this is pleasing to the Lord. And then the fourth type of offering is called the sin offering. And these are required for specific sins that a person might commit. Whenever a person commits a sin, they offer a specific sacrifice according to all the regulations that are explained in Leviticus in detail. And then the fifth is a guilt offering. And these are required for general guilt. Not for specific sins, but for the guilt of conscious or unconscious sin in general. And like the first three, these last two types of sacrifices also have a summary statement that comes up every time through that these are explained in Leviticus. And the statement is, the priest shall make atonement on his behalf for his sin, and he shall be forgiven. And this repeated refrain proclaims that when these offerings are made, the people are assured that their sin is effectively dealt with. Because God himself has commanded these sacrifices, and he's assured that through them, their sins would be covered. And then the next section in Leviticus talks about acceptable priesthood. In chapter 8, Aaron and his sons are consecrated as priests. Then in chapter 9, they begin their priestly work. They offer sacrifices which are accepted by God. And then, by way of contrast, in chapter 10, Nadab and Abihu, two of Aaron's four sons, they offer sacrifices which are not accepted by God. We're told that they offered sacrifices which God had not commanded them. That is, they made sacrifices on their own initiative, their own decision, and not in obedience to God's commands. And because of it, God killed them. And this sends the very clear message that God expects to be worshipped in his way, not in our way. He makes the rules, not us. And even in today's church, we need to beware of pushing the idea of creativity and innovation in worship too far, because there is a point where it becomes unacceptable to God if we stray from his revealed instructions of how he wants to be worshipped. So make sure your manner of worship is formed more by God's revelation than it is by our culture or by somebody's personal preferences or even your own personal preference. And the reason given in chapter 10 why Aaron's two sons were killed is he will be honored and he will show himself holy among his people. That is, he will not be worshipped the way all the other gods of the other nations are because he's not like them. Then the next section describes acceptable worshipers. And in this section is the idea of clean and unclean. Now this concept may seem foreign to us, so let me try to help with a couple illustrations. First, imagine the president or the queen of England or somebody famous or somebody really special to you. They're going to visit your house. Well, wouldn't you clean? You would put away your dirty socks and your dishes, and you would want everything to be right and perfect. And you would actually be pretty picky to not allow anything wrong, anything stained, anything disgusting to be there in your house, right? And if you did, the uncleanness of your house might be taken as ground for offense for two reasons. First, your dirty socks are disgusting. And second, that you didn't care enough about them to do something about it. How much more should God be offended by any vileness and uncleanness among his people when he's present among them? And second illustration to try to help you understand, you know, remember the distinction between what is holy and what is common. God differentiates between what is holy and pure those things being set apart for him, those things that are in proximity to his character, as opposed to what is common, therefore unclean. The world is stained by sin, and God is completely holy. And a sharp distinction is made between the two. And God delineates what is acceptable, what is clean, and what is unacceptable. Now, these are imperfect illustrations. Please don't press them too far. But I hope they help you to see why God takes the concept of clean and unclean seriously. And these chapters teach God's people how to have cleanliness, how to be clean in some specific issues, so as to honor and avoid offending God. Chapter 11 describes clean and unclean food. Chapter 12 talks about childbirth. Chapter 13 and 14 addresses fungus and various skin diseases. And chapter 15 gives regulations about various body discharges. And then this whole big section climaxes in chapter 16 with the Day of Atonement. And the Day of Atonement is one of the key ideas of Leviticus. And it's one of the most important days on the Israelite calendar. On this day, all the people would abstain from food, any food, and multiple sacrifices were offered to atone for everything. You know, sacrifice after sacrifice after sacrifice. Every part of the tabernacle was atoned for. And sacrifices were made for every part of Israelite life. And then the high priest entered the most holy place, and he splashed blood on the atonement cover of the Ark of the Covenant. Remember, this is the only time of year that he entered this most holy place. And the scapegoat symbolically took the sin of the people away outside the camp. One animal was killed as a sacrifice, a blood sacrifice, and one animal was sent away. And they both symbolically took away sins. And the result of all this on the Day of Atonement, stated in chapter 16, verse 30, was all would be clean. God provided a way to be forgiven, to be clean, and it worked by God's grace. And then the second major section teaches about how to live rightly. And like I mentioned, this section is often called the Holiness Code because the word holy is used manifold times. And the result of people following these laws in that culture is that they would be made holy. Now, there's a whole variety of laws we don't have time to go into. It includes such things as moral laws, Sabbath laws, vows, tithes, and many other issues covering all parts of Israelite life. And all of these laws are based in some way on God's character. So in some way, they are a revelation of God's character. So also, his people were to imitate his character by following these laws. Remember, be holy because I am holy. Then the other major reason given in Leviticus for all of these laws and for following all these laws is I am Yahweh. Again, this is an appeal to his character, but also to his lordship. It's kind of like when your parent said, you'll do this because I said so, because I'm the parent. In a certain way, God says, you're going to do this because I'm God and you're not. Now, that's not a cheap cop-out, because he is God. Let me give you one example of this that addresses an issue that's fairly controversial in our day and age. Chapter 18 gives specific rules about sex, with whom God's people may engage in sex and with whom they may not. But these commands, these prohibitions, they don't come out of the blue. Look at how this chapter begins. In verses 1 through 5 of this chapter, before he says anything about sex, God says, I am Yahweh your God. Do not do like all these other nations do. You must follow my laws and rules. I am Yahweh. Keep my rules and you will live. I am Yahweh. You see, the point he's making in this, he is Lord and he makes the rules, and his people must be holy. Now, we also know that he's gracious and wise, and the rules that he makes are in our best interest and for our protection over time. And if we live by his rules, we will be happy and blessed. But that's not the reason he gives here. He says, you will do this because I'm God. So we can't ever compromise the fact that he is the one who has the right to determine right and wrong, and we do not. And by the way, neither does our surrounding culture. Our courts don't have this right. No one has this right except God. Only God is Lord and Master and boss. And by the way, in our culture then, whenever these issues are discussed, instead of the church just kind of debating, this is right, this is wrong, because I said so, no, because I said so, we might consider going further back and raising the question, who really has the right to make these decisions, and talk about why. Okay, that's my 2 cents. And that's a brief survey of the content of the book of Leviticus. So now let's look at the theological themes of Leviticus. The first theme is sacrifice and atonement. Now, we've seen the Day of Atonement, and we've seen the 5 types of sacrifices. And in Leviticus, we learn that God has graciously given a substitute of blood. One life given instead of the life of the sinner. And that means the sinner gets to keep living. And the substitute sacrifice covers the sin and brings forgiveness. And the word atonement actually means covering. And when a sin is atoned through authorized sacrifice, God no longer holds it against them. Then the second theme is holiness. And we've seen in Leviticus, God's people must be separate, not common. Israel must be different from all the surrounding nations. And God's people must stand out as different from people who don't know God. If we're no different, if we act no different, if we think no different, something is wrong. We need to be set apart for God, to be like God in moral purity, because God himself is holy, and he is our moral standard. And then the third theme is festivals. Now, we barely touched on this yet, but it is an important idea in the book of Leviticus. There are certain times every year, like the Day of Atonement, when God's people celebrated and dedicated time for God, but also in community with all of Israel. This is the original idea of a holiday. That word means a holy day. These are holy days given to God. These are times set aside for fellowship with and worship of God. And all the specific festivals required for ancient Israel, they're described in detail in Leviticus. These then are the theological themes that we've seen in this book. So now, let's review. The organization of Leviticus is around the 2 goals of its instruction, and they are right worship and right living. And the theological themes of Leviticus are sacrifice, holiness, and festivals. Now, I hope that this gives you a new appreciation for this neglected book. Yes, it is a difficult book, but it actually is a very influential book on the New Testament understanding of sacrifice and atonement, and therefore it helps explain the cross of Christ. And by the way, the New Testament book of Hebrews is basically an exposition of the ideas in the book of Leviticus. So I hope you're encouraged to explore Leviticus a bit more. Now, in the next section, we'll move on and we'll look at the book of Numbers. And I'm looking forward to it. Thanks for watching.